Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and it's my pleasure and privilege to present once again Peter Vogel, the author of the article The Last Wave from Port Chicago, from the Black Scholars issue of spring of 1982, developing a very compelling argument that the explosion of the E.A. Bryan, a World War II ammunition ship in Suisun Bay in the San Francisco Bay Area, was in fact the explosion and in all likelihood the deliberate test of an early nuclear weapon. Peter, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Thanks, Dave. It's good to be back.
All righty. Now, in our last discussion of the previous half hour, we discussed how in August of 1944, or shortly after the Port Chicago explosion in July of 44, Los Alamos Laboratory shifted its focal point of research to developing the lenses necessary for the plutonium implosion device. Now, implosion, I guess, is the watchword here. Tell us about how that weapon worked and what makes that different from the gun weapon that we were talking about earlier.
The implosion technology, which was used in the Nagasaki weapon, was based on the fact that if you have a sphere of plutonium and you can compress it significantly, that is, reduce its cross-section, it will become a critical mass. You take a subcritical mass of plutonium and squeeze it, and if you squeeze it enough, it diminishes in size so much that it will become a supercritical mass and then explode like as an atomic bomb. Now, the first implosion concept was not a sphere. It was a cylinder, a tube. And the first test of the cylindrical implosion model was made on the 4th of July, 1943. So that's a year before the Port Chicago explosion. At the testing facility called Anchor Ranch at Los Alamos, Seth Niedermeyer, with Captain Parsons present and observing, detonated the first cylindrical explosion. Now, this was a 5-inch interior diameter mild steel pipe that was about 5 feet long, and it had RDX explosive wrapped around it as a blanket, and then it had multi-point detonators all at different positions along the pipe and on its circumference. And hopefully those would all detonate at once, and it would crush this material and crush the pipe and make the whole thing smaller than it had been. That was the objective. Now, the cylinder actually was developed into a weapon, which was known as Mark II. The implosion device that was finally perfected for use at Nagasaki was spherical, and the implosion, the wave of the implosion, was reinforced by the fact that the explosives that surrounded the plutonium were molded like lenses, and they focused the implosion and really squeezed the plutonium at the interior of that. Now, that was the Mark IV weapon, the Nagasaki weapon. A predecessor of that was also a spherical plutonium implosion weapon, but it did not use focusing lenses to optimize the shape of the implosion wave. And then the very first implosion device was what's known as Mark II, and this was the cylindrical implosion.
Now, Mark I was the Nagasaki-type gun weapon?
Yes, that's correct. It,
okay.
It used a gun mechanism.
And the other three devices are implosion devices. Mark IV, the Nagasaki device, Mark III, an earlier precursor of that. Tell us about the Mark II, Peter.
Well, the Mark II, you know, there's really, Dave, there was, when I started looking at this, there was only one reference. In fact, there still is only one reference in all the published government histories about the Manhattan Project. There's only one reference to Mark II, and that occurs in a book that was published in 1962 called The New World. And he says that it was a low-yield device that could use either plutonium or uranium. And I began to look at that. I was pretty sure at that point that any test of an atomic bomb that had been made at Port Chicago could not have been made using either the Mark IV or the Mark III or the gun assembly weapon, the Mark I. So I began looking very, very closely at Mark II and tried to find out as much information as I could about it. And that's the trail that opened up now about 3 years ago.
And tell us about the Mark II. Tell us about what it has a very complicated name. And if you would first give us the name and then explain how this actually worked.
Well, it is the autocatalytic uranium hydride lateral implosion experimental device. Now, I had gotten to the point of being able to identify it as a cylindrical implosion assembly weapon, but I didn't know very much more than that about it. And I was talking to Vice Admiral Frederick L. Ashworth, who was the bombardier on the Nagasaki flight, and I said, Admiral, we were talking about Port Chicago, and we were talking about Captain Parsons, and I said, you know, I believe that an atomic bomb was detonated at Port Chicago, and I think it was this device called Mark II, but I can't figure out what it is. And he wrote back to me, and he said Mark II was the autocatalytic uranium hydride lateral implosion experimental device. So then, you know, whoa, I knew what the device was, I knew what to call it, but what was uranium hydride? I mean, there's no record in the literature, at least I hadn't found it then, of any kind of a device that was even contemplated at Los Alamos that used uranium hydride as a fissionable material. Everything was to be either plutonium or 235 enriched uranium. And all of a sudden, it's a hydride bomb. And it was a very, very interesting device, as we finally been able to figure it out. It used the same cylinder of mild steel so that it would not fracture. And around this pipe were layers of uranium hydride, and then a layer of paraffin impregnated with boron-10, which is a neutron absorber, and then another layer of the hydride, and then another layer of the boron and paraffin, and several layers of this were built up until it produced a weapon that, when it detonated, created a yield of about 600 tons, TNT equivalent. And then all around the circumference of this pipe, there were fuses and detonators. And the idea was that when the weapon was detonated, that the explosion of the RDX material would begin to compress the pipe, and it would get hot, and as that happened, the boron and paraffin would be expelled from the ends of the weapon, and that boron isotope 10 acted to absorb stray neutrons so that the weapon wouldn't accidentally explode. Well, when you blow that paraffin and the boron 10 out and you compress those other layers of uranium hydride, you get a supercritical mass at the center of this pipe, and it exploded. Now, uranium hydride is a really interesting thing. I had assumed that atmospheric hydrogen had been used as a hydrogen in uranium hydride compound, but it wasn't. Maury Shapiro, the chief scientist emeritus of the Naval Research Laboratory, called me up a few weeks ago, and he said, Peter, it was the deuteride, and it was not atmospheric hydrogen that was used in the uranium hydride compound. It was the deuteride isotope of hydrogen, heavy hydrogen, and that considerably increased the efficiency of the device.
Now, excuse me, Peter, let me interrupt briefly. Could
sure.
you explain about the different isotopes of hydrogen for people who are not familiar with that?
Well, isotopes are atoms of an element which are chemically identical, but they have a slightly different atomic weight.
Right.
The same is true of the uranium isotopes, uranium-235 and 238 are the isotopes of uranium. Hydrogen has two isotopes, those, especially deuterium, became the basis for the nuclear fission bomb, the hydrogen bomb. So the uranium hydride weapon that apparently was detonated at Port Chicago was a precursor of the hydrogen bomb, the fusion bomb.
And so this actually, the Mark II, was pointing toward the development of the hydrogen bomb.
It was. The hydrogen bomb, of course, was Dr. Ed Teller's brainchild, and he was the one that conceived of it. And he wanted it tested very badly. He pushed it was called the super, the H-bomb, and he had been pushing on the super on the hydrogen bomb from the time he got to Los Alamos early in 1943.
Mm-hmm.
And he subsequently developed this into the workable weapon that it was when he left Los Alamos at the end of World War II and went to the newly created Lawrence Livermore Laboratory. He took the Mark II uranium hydride technology with him and subsequently tested that device again twice at the Nevada test site in 1953, Ruth and Ray.
And we also should remember that the plutonium device also had implications for the development of the H-bomb.
Well, it did.
In terms of the explosive lenses.
Mm-hmm. Well, what you said is actually correct, too, that it was necessary to develop the weapons that were used against Japan in combat during World War II, because those would be the trigger for the hydrogen bomb. But in effect, the Mark II device was a hybrid of fission and fusion bomb and demonstrated the enhanced potential of a deuterium bomb.
Now, back to the quest for the truth about Fort Chicago. You came across this Mark II, and you also, during the course of your research, came across correspondence between some of the principal players in the Manhattan Project in the summer of 1944 about the Mark II.
Mm-hmm. I found, during the time I was at Stanford, in the library there, there's a microfilm collection that was put together by the National Archives in 1980 or 82. And I was reading through that and found materials that were recorded by Harvard University President James B. Conant. Now, Conant was General Leslie Groves' scientific advisor, and Dr. Conant was also a member of the President Roosevelt's Atomic Bomb Policy Committee. So he really knew everything that was going on there. And I first found a document of his, which is called Historical Note, written July 27, 1944. So that's a few days after the Port Chicago explosion that it was written. And what it reports is a meeting that was held at the University of Chicago on the 17th of July, 1944, that Monday, the day Port Chicago exploded. And he, that is, Dr. Conant, reports in these notes that he had a conversation with Robert Oppenheimer at the University of Chicago, and he says, I propose that we test Mark II as soon as possible, and if it works, we can put it on the shelf as Mark II, and we can proceed with less nervousness on the more powerful weapons.
And this was in at what time frame?
That is the record of a conversation that was held the early afternoon of the day of the Port Chicago explosion, 17th of July, 1944.
So it's the very same day as Port Chicago took place. Oppenheimer recommended to Conant or the other way around?
Conant recommends it to Oppenheimer.
That this would be a really good time, that we should test Mark II, and if it works, we can put it on the shelf.
Right, and it's going to be interesting to find out that this conversation that's recorded here actually occurred a number of hours before the Port Chicago explosion, and Oppenheimer's response that's recorded here is that it's a little too early, but he agrees that a test should be conducted of Mark II as soon as possible.
Now, one of the things that figures into the story, too, is something called the B-radius or B-radius blast damage.
It's the radius of Class B damage.
Radius of Class B damage. Could you tell us a little bit about what that is and how that figures into the investigation?
Sure. An explosion, according to how far a structure or person or any obstacle may be to an explosion, either it will be absolutely destroyed, it will be badly damaged, or it will be slightly damaged. Now, Class A damage is it's gone. Class B damage is it's still there, but it's unusable and has to be torn down.
Mm-hmm.
Class C damage is it's repairable and can be put back in service. The Class B radius of damage is what's important because that includes total destruction and it includes everything that cannot be rebuilt and has to be torn down and reconstructed. So that's the important factor in an explosion if you're trying to determine what the damage is going to be.
And the B radius damage, Class B damage, was a central focal point of interest to the people involved in the Manhattan Project.
1 month after the Port Chicago explosion, Harvard President James Conant is back at Los Alamos, having a meeting with the same men that he met with them, at the University of Chicago, including Oppenheimer and Captain Parsons and Edward Teller. And he writes a memorandum on the 17th of August, 1 month after the Port Chicago explosion, and he says to General Groves, it has been decided, it has been agreed, to put Mark II on the shelf, knowing that it could be developed for combat use in 3 or 4 months' time. It represents an almost sure thing which we may have to fall back on for using plutonium.
And this this was a document, as I recall, there were a two-page document, and those were the only two sentences that were left in the document?
Well, that's almost true. The other thing that's left is the radius of Class B damage for the Port Chicago explosion.
Right. And do you have the document in front of you, Peter?
Yeah, I do.
If you would read, now bear in mind, but since this is radio, we can't show people the document, a picture of it. This is a two-page document. The entire document was redacted. It was blacked out, deemed classified, not fit for release, except for these two sentences. And if you would read those verbatim into the record, please, Peter.
Sure. There are a couple of them here. This is on the second page of this memorandum to General Groves, dated August 17, 1944, from James Conant. And he says, if the explosive lens development, that's Mark IV, then looks very bad, it may be necessary to work on improving Mark II to see if at least the upper limit of effectiveness, and that's blanked out, whatever that was, 1 kiloton, cannot be raised somewhat. And then in the following paragraph, number 6, entitled Note on Explosive Damage, he says, it was agreed that Class B damage was damage beyond repair. For the phrase to be of significance, the type of structure must also be named. It was agreed that for dwelling houses, which is an archetypical design, the area of Class B damage was about as follows. For 1,000 tons TNT, Class B damage equals 0.5-mile radius equals 0.75-square-mile area. Now, that is the radius of the Class B damage for Port Chicago, and that is reported in James Conant's memorandum to General Groves of the 17th of August, 1944. So the rationale for putting Mark II on the shelf is based on the Port Chicago explosion.
The point is that the B damage for Port Chicago is basically the reference point for the Mark II B damage.
That's true, and it also is the rationale for the decision to put Mark II on the shelf and the acknowledgement that it has the combat the development potential for combat use within 3 or 4 months' time from August.
Not only do I find that fascinating and from a logical, analytical standpoint compelling, but bear in mind that this is a two-page document, and the rest of the document was blacked out. It would be really, really interesting to see if those were the sentences that they left in, what did they take out?
I know, it really is. Well, I found out a little bit more about it. A friend of mine was able to get some more information on it, but nothing that adds anything significant to it.
Where is your investigation pointing to at this point, Peter? Or what are you in a position to tell us, bearing in mind that this is a sensitive topic?
The study that I've made, former Defense Secretary William Perry calls an investigation, which may be the more appropriate word than study. My investigation and the findings that I've made have been now reviewed by Professor of History Barton Bernstein at Stanford, who's an extremely competent judge of these matters, being as he is the most proficient historian in the subject. They've been reviewed by the Naval Research Laboratory, scientists and historians, and all the material is on the table now. It looks very much as if we're going to have to concede that there was at least a considerable likelihood that Mark II was tested at Port Chicago. Now, in order to get an accurate estimate of that possibility before the public, one of the large metropolitan daily newspapers in the Bay Area is going to undertake, beginning the first week of February, a review of all the associated materials about Mark II and about the Port Chicago explosion. The newspaper is going to interview all of the people that I've interviewed over the years who can contribute information about Mark II, and they're going to publish the analysis.
All righty. Well, hopefully The article will not be interdicted. I've seen articles underway interdicted when they dealt with matters that were too sensitive. So hopefully this will come to fruition.
Well, I hope it will. So far, I haven't had that kind of a problem. But as you say, interdiction is always a possibility because there's a lot of information here about the design and technology of a nuclear weapon that has never been published before. And it's, even to my own thinking, it's almost a shame in a way that that we now know as much about this weapon as we do, because it has a considerable potential, I believe, as a low-yield, portable nuclear weapon that could be conveyed to a target by truck or by rail car.
So it was something that a terrorist group or relatively low-tech nation could conceivably develop?
Quite conceivably. It would be quite easy. And now we begin to understand more fully why the United States was so insistent on recovering the heavy water from the Norwegian heavy water-producing plant. All it takes, really, is a little bit of slightly enriched uranium and some heavy hydrogen and a little engineering technology, and you've got this thing put together. Now, since this is all going to come out, Dave, I want to tell you exactly what the amount of fissionable material was that was used in the Mark II.
Mm-hmm.
And this is taken, again, from a report of a trip to Los Alamos made by James Conant on the 4th of July, 1944. And we can learn from this document that for Mark II, 9 kilograms of the isotope 235, uranium-235, was employed, and 2 kilograms of plutonium were anticipated to be employed in the Mark II. It could use either plutonium or slightly enriched uranium. It did use 9 kilograms of the isotope 235, and that was in an admixture of natural uranium to an enrichment, by my estimate, of about 20% 235.
Mm-hmm. Also, another interesting point is one of your correspondents apparently exhibited some reluctance, I believe this was a retired naval officer, indicated that if the truth were to come out about Port Chicago, it could be deleterious because it could leave the Navy open to lawsuits.
Well, you know, Admiral Ashworth had mentioned that possibility, and I think it's inevitable. People are going to sue, and I don't know how it's going to be settled, hopefully equitably. These men were subjected to a necessary military test, in my opinion, a military and historical imperative. But nonetheless, at this date, I mean, people are being compensated for the indignities that they were made to suffer during World War II, and I think these men certainly did suffer an indignity.
And we should note that the Port Chicago explosion led to a large-scale mutiny by black sailors, and that has been a major focal point of African-American history in regard to the history of the last 50 or 60 years.
Those are going to be covered pretty well in two television documentaries that are forthcoming. CBS News Productions last month finished a film, a documentary, one-hour documentary history on the Port Chicago explosion that I'm told is to be broadcast on the History Channel in February. Morgan Freeman, the actor who most people would know perhaps from Driving Miss Daisy, but a very fine actor and a former Air Force officer, he is now executive producer of a miniseries docudrama on the Port Chicago Mutiny that's to be broadcast sometime in the next few months by NBC.
All right. Well, we will be looking for that. We're speaking, by the way, on January 24th of 1999. Peter, let me just take a minute, because obviously a lot of the discussion has been highly technical, and review some of the key points of information for members of the audience. First of all, you came across a document quite by accident, the history of the 10,000-ton gadget about the development of a nuclear weapon, and it referred to the mushroom cloud mushrooming out at 18,000 feet in typical Port Chicago fashion. If this was the explosion of an ammunition ship, why would that reference be made? in this history of a nuclear weapon. Although the official explanation was given that the gun weapon was not tested because there was not enough uranium available at that time, that turned out to be untrue. The explosion gave off a brilliant white flash. Some witnesses reported the entire area being lit to the brightness of daylight. A white flash is characteristic of nuclear explosions and is not characteristic of the explosion of TNT and Torpex, which gives a yellow or orange flash. Most of the explosives on the E.A. Bryan, according to explosives experts, would not have gone off high order, and therefore the magnitude of the explosion could not be accounted for by the conventional explosives on board that ship. The E.A. Bryan, the ammunition ship on which the bomb appears to have been secreted, had heavier booms put on shortly before that in order to handle a larger weight than had previously been demanded. That is consistent with the weight of a nuclear weapon. A film, ostensibly a test film, made in Hollywood in order to demonstrate why Port Chicago should be incorporated into the Concord Naval Weapons Station, but a film you believe to be an actual record of the Port Chicago test, turned out to have been made on a type of film that was not available at the time that the film, a type of film that was no longer being used when that film was ostensibly put together, indicating basically deception and cover-up. The explosion created what appeared to have been a Wilson condensation cloud, characteristic only of nuclear explosions over water. Edward Teller exhibited a considerable degree of agitation when you showed him your document, The History of the 10,000-Ton Gadget, saying he would never admit to having seen that document. One wonders why he would be so uncomfortable about a document talking about Port Chicago. I would also point out that the Army and Navy Explosive Safety Board Technical Paper Number 6, the report on the explosion of the E.A. Bryan, was reclassified top secret after your article was published in the spring of 1982. One could only imagine what could be more mundane than a report of the explosion of the World War II ammunition ship almost 40 years later. I would point out that Captain Parsons, the bombing officer on board the Enola Gay and in charge of the bikini tests, later Operation Crossroads, wrote the report on the Port Chicago explosion for Los Alamos, and there was a great deal of interest in that explosion on the part of Los Alamos. The switch to the development of the plutonium implosion device took place about a month after Port Chicago. The records indicate that two railroad cars that were loaded at Los Alamos and shipped to Port Chicago had the records of their contents destroyed, again indicating a cover-up. You had a break-in in which your papers were stolen. Then you came across the Mark II weapon, which was an implosion device and one of the precursors of the hydrogen bomb. This was the Mark II. The day the Port Chicago explosion took place, correspondence between Robert Oppenheimer and James Conant indicated the desire on the part of some of the participants to test Mark II. And then a month after the explosion, in a two-page document, most of which was redacted, it was pointed out that the B radius damage was consistent with the one kiloton explosion and referenced basically the damage radius of Port Chicago as indicating that the Mark II worked and that the Mark II could then be put on the shelf and developed for use for combat within 3 or 4 months. Again, all of that information taken in concert, I believe, pointing very strongly to the correctness of your original hypothesis that that was a nuke and in all probability a deliberate test. Peter, we are almost out of time. I want to thank you once again for your work and thank you for spending some time with us.
Well, thank you, Dave. You've done just a wonderful summary of this history over the years, and the summary that you made tonight is just flawless. Thank you very much.
All righty. For Peter Vogel, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.